they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers
and Kevin Zeiss.
And Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to us on Apple, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find us at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, check out our store. You'll find Clearing the Fog gear like bumper stickers, t-shirts, water bottles, and tote bags.
And also while you're there, check out our daily news digest. You can sign up for free. It provides you with 10 to 15 stories a day, brief summaries. You can click on the story and get the full story and then share it, become part of the media. And also our weekly news analysis, our newsletter, goes in deep into issues that are the focus of the movement. It's a great way to really get to understand issues in depth that you don't get in the corporate media.
Those are both free, and you'll find them at popularresistance.org. So this week, we interviewed Professor Richard Wolff.
Richard Wolff is a great economist, has a real strong Marxist analysis. He's making a prediction, which is pretty bold, which is that capitalism may not survive this pandemic.
Right, so we go into depth on how capitalism is connected to the crises we face and why it needs to end now and how that happens. So before we get into that interview, let's talk about some things that are in the news. So let's start with our COVID-19 update as we do each week. We now in the United States have over 5.2 million documented cases and over 165,000 deaths.
And that means that the United States has more than a quarter of all the cases in the world. The world's approaching 20 million, and almost a quarter, about 24% of the deaths in the world. So the U.S. is performing very poorly compared to other nations around the world.
Reminding people that the United States only constitutes 5% of the world's population. It's August and folks are returning to school. Much of them are online, but in some places, students are having to go back to school in person.
And that's turning schools into a pandemic spreading zone.
Interesting, last week there were some students at North Paulding High School in Georgia who shared some photos of basically their classrooms and their hallways showing that there was a very low proportion of students wearing masks. Students were crowded together. And lo and behold, after 1 week of school, the school's having to shut down temporarily because they have cases of COVID-19 in students and staff. And actually, there were cases starting in the football team prior to school opening, and teachers also who had tested positive prior to the opening.
The wrong people were suspended at that school. They suspended those students for publishing the truth. Truth that the principal and the school system did not want seen. The people who should be suspended are the principals and those who put the kids back into that dangerous situation. Those students who showed the truth deserve to get prizes for letting the country know the danger of kids going back to school.
There were also some leaked audio from meetings that were held of the school staff. And one of the rules that I think Georgia has to do with if someone is in contact for more than 15 minutes with someone who's positive with COVID-19, that has to be reported. So the school was actually going to ask the students to rotate their desks every 14 minutes so they wouldn't be in contact with a person for 15 minutes or more.
This is a school administration that does not know what they're doing. They do not know how to respond to this crisis. Perhaps they're being pushed open and doing their best to handle it, but it seems like they are pretty incompetent. And this is a school system in deep trouble.
And other school systems around the country, as they've reopened, have also had to order hundreds of staff and students to go into quarantine because of being exposed to people with COVID-19.
Schools reopening is a big fear for parents, for students, for teachers, people who work in the schools. There's lots of discussions going around the country between teachers and their unions and the school systems. There's lots of concerns. The big mistake, just like the rush to reopen, which led to the pandemic getting worse in the United States, the big mistake is the rush to reopen schools at a time when the pandemic is spreading out of control and before schools put in place the basic public health measures needed to protect students, teacher, and staff.
Right, and before schools even have the resources to be able to do that, of course, Congress is still, you know, stuck, not able to come up with an agreement on legislation to provide support during this pandemic and recession. And it looks like Trump is trumping the Democrats.
Well, the Democrats were negotiating with the White House. Mitch McConnell was staying out of it. He knew that his senators, the Republican senators, were divided, so he didn't know what to do in the Senate. And so the White House and the Democrats, including Chuck Schumer from the Senate, were negotiating. Democrats put forward a $3 trillion proposal, which was, in our view, too low by about $1 trillion. But they negotiated to go to $2 trillion, which was giving up the farm. But the White House refused to budge from their $1 trillion inadequate proposal. Now that we see how Trump's responded, that seems like an intentional ploy by the Trump administration.
Right. It looks like they basically wanted to create a situation where the Democrats and the Republicans could not reach agreement. And now Trump is putting out these executive orders to come in, and I guess, and be the one, the hero who stops evictions and things like that.
Stops evictions, helps with student loan debt, continues unemployment support, and then reduces cuts the payroll tax for those under $100,000 income. Yeah, I mean, the question is, first off, those four steps sound nice as headlines, but you go to the details, they're all inadequate. None of them do what needs to be done. And second, the question is its legality of each of them. This is a power grab by the White House taking on the power to decide taxes. That is clearly not allowed in the Constitution. The financing of the government comes from the Congress, so it's an amazing move by Donald Trump to take that power onto himself. But it puts Democrats in a tough position. Are they going to come out and sue about, you can't stop foreclosures, you can't help student loan debt,
right,
you can't pay unemployed workers? I mean, those are all things the Democrats support, even if they're inadequate in Trump's version. Those are all things Democrats support. So what are they going to sue to stop him? Puts Democrats in a very tough situation.
It does. And we should remind our listeners that with President Trump, you know, if he were able to stop the payroll tax, what does that do to the future of Social Security and Medicare, which are financed through those taxes?
And he says that if he's reelected, he will make that a permanent end of the payroll tax, which means the permanent source of revenue for Medicare and Social Security, two critical programs that every person over 65 is on, many disabled people are on. Critical programs for the really survival of tens of millions of people would be underfunded and difficult to continue.
About a third of the population in the United States is on either Medicare or Medicaid.
I mean, of course, if we were willing to tax the wealthy and go into debt further, we could continue to fund these programs. But the Congress is not, a Congress that believes in unlimited debt. The Republicans don't believe in modern monetary theory, and they don't believe in the greenback system of Congress taking back the power to create money. So all the ways you could fund these programs with no problem are not available. And so we're relying on the payroll tax. They cut the payroll tax, you're cutting Social Security and Medicare.
You know, one talking point that we keep hearing primarily from the Republicans is, and from Steve Mnuchin, I guess, from the Treasury, is you can't pay people to not work. Very upset about the extra weekly allowance that people on unemployment support have been receiving. But a few studies have shown that what he's talking about doesn't make sense, that in fact a Yale study found that the higher payments did not deter people from returning to work. And another study that was conducted by Glassdoor, the New York Fed, and University of Pennsylvania found that employers had no problem finding employees for their vacancies. There's lots of people out there looking for jobs.
The problem is the lack of jobs, not the lack of employees. People want to work, people want an income, but their job situation, because of the economic collapse, is just non-existent. So this seems like a false argument. I'm not sure why they're even making it.
It's a political argument.
I mean, Even the studies on basic income show that when people get a basic income, they still want to work because the basic income is not all they give them all they need. And work actually can be a fulfilling thing if you can get do work that you believe in and you want to do. So it really is a false argument. I'm not sure why they're making it, but it's an ideological idea that the government needs to force people to work.
And of course, we need to mention what's happening to the Postal Service. Very serious situation there with the firing of many of the top level people, slowing down the mail. We've talked about this before. It's all an approach to basically completely undermine the post office and allow it to be privatized and sold off.
And the Postmaster General that Trump has appointed, who has no experience in this area, is doing what he calls cost cutting measures. That is slowing the Postal Service down, making the less reliable service to people. And this is all part of how neoliberalism works. You underfund, you minimize the program,
deregulate.
You make it so that people don't like it, and then they're willing to privatize it. And that's really what this is all about. Plus, the other ripple in this is, what's the impact if you go to a mail-in ballot if the post office is not operating well?
Right. A lot of people are, pointing the fingers at Republicans and saying, oh, these bad, bad Republicans are killing the post office. But it's true that the big law that hurt the post office back in 2006 was passed by Republicans. But then there was 8 years of Democrats, and, you know, and part of that where there was a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate. I don't recall them, you know, trying to save the post office at that point, trying to repeal that law.
No, I said you saw Dianne Feinstein's husband, the senator from California. He was making profit in his real estate business, selling off beautiful postal service buildings.
New Deal era, yeah.
New Deal era postal service, but he was making a lot of money selling those off. So they were corrupt as well. And truly, the Democrats could have saved the post office by repealing that 2006 law that made the post office have 75 years of medical and retirement funds for employees they even hired yet.
In reserve, yeah. No business is asked to do anything like that. The protests across the country against police violence are continuing, particularly on the West Coast. But in North Carolina, there's an occupation called Occupy the Block. It's in its fourth week in front of the Forsyth County Courthouse, organized by the Triad Abolition Project. What sparked this occupation is the murder of a prisoner by corrections officers, John Neville, who was suffocated in prison, and they haven't been able to get information about how that death occurred. In fact, the state has been trying to put a law in place that would make it harder for people to get information. So they're calling for transparency. They think the public should be notified about deaths in custody, and they also think that there should be a change in the use of force policies.
As usual, protesters are making very reasonable requests. Transparency, notification of deaths, that seems so basic. And yet the response of the government is to push back on the protesters, to deny them the reasonable requests they're making because the government is hiding their violence. And this is a problem we see throughout the country.
Also, some interesting court decisions recently. Let's start out with one in Louisiana Supreme Court, which unfortunately upheld a decision against a man named Fairwayne Bryant, who's been given a life sentence. He's already served 23 years of that for trying to steal some hedge clippers. And people are saying that this law that they've used, this habitual offender law, is similar to the pig laws that were used during Reconstruction.
The pig laws that would arrest black people for minor offenses and force them to work on pig farms. But this kind of habitual offender law is very much like the three strikes laws we see in other states. It results in people who have committed a minor offense, like stealing hedge clippers, and because of their third offense, they get these lengthy sentences. This is one of the many reasons why the U.S. leads the world in mass incarceration. Louisiana is certainly a state that's had a terrible criminal justice system for a very long time, but it's not alone. California also has a three strikes law. In fact, Kamala Harris, when she was attorney general, fought against reducing the penalties for that three strikes law. So this is a problem we have across the country. You know, Louisiana is certainly an example of a very abusive criminal justice system.
And in Louisiana, there are racial disparities, as we see across the country. 80% of prisoners who are incarcerated under this habitual offender law are black, while the population is 32% black in Louisiana. Let's look at Utah, where in Salt Lake City, protesters who used red paint, symbolizing the blood for police violence, are being charged with felony criminal mischief and facing potentially a life sentence.
And the way they escalated that to a life sentence was they made it a gang-related crime, which has an escalation clause in Utah. This action by the district attorney is opposed by the mayor, by city officials, by local civil rights groups. The woman who's being charged with a potential life sentence, her role in this was purchasing the paint.
And then in Mississippi, this is really interesting, federal judge Carlton Reeves, in his decision, argued that qualified immunity for police prevents him from being able to hold police accountable when they abuse their office.
This is the problem that lower level judges often have with our abusive criminal justice system. You know, we've seen it with mandatory sentencing, where judges are not allowed to sentence people based on the individuality of the case. They're forced because of mandatory sentence or because of a mandatory sentencing guideline to issue a sentence they don't believe in. And now we have this kind of same situation here, where a judge sees a police officer who deserves to be held accountable, but because of qualified immunity upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, the judge cannot take action to hold that police officer accountable.
In Colorado, they passed a law getting rid of qualified immunity, so we'll see what happens in that situation. It would also require police to pay personally a portion of judgment when they are abusive. In Missouri, CoreCivic, the private prison, was ordered to pay pay $3.7 million for recording attorney-client conversations in a pre-detention center and feeding those conversations to law enforcement.
Well, they got caught, and that's the difference between that and other situations. I mean, this is always a concern for lawyers with clients in jail. Can they trust the prison system to keep attorney-client confidentiality? Here, obviously in Missouri, they couldn't. It'd be interesting to see how widespread that was, what kind of cases were impacted, and what the courts do about it.
In Colombia, the former president, Alvaro Uribe, has been ordered to be held under house arrest for bribery and fraud.
And Uribe is the current president's mentor, so this really impacts the current political situation. Uribe was a very violent president, very involved with death squads, and now he's being caught with bribery and attempting to influence witnesses, and so he's facing prosecution himself.
This week for our newsletter, we wrote about the U.S.'s attempts to intervene in three countries, Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Venezuela, and how in some ways it shows, you know, the U.S. empire in decline and the U.S.'s ability to intervene. In many cases, failing, although in Bolivia, it's a very serious situation.
Well, it's a big fight in Bolivia. It's evident from polls that the MAS party candidate would win in the first ballot, the first round of elections. And so the dictator, the self-appointed president, Inez, has delayed elections twice now. People in the street blocking roads. Thousands of people are protesting. The country's becoming impossible to govern. On top of that, they have a massive COVID pandemic because the government is so incapable of handling it. They kicked out all the Cuban doctors. It was one of their first steps. Then COVID hit and they're just not prepared. But the people are rebelling in Bolivia against the stalling of the elections.
And in Nicaragua, a document was discovered that was put out by USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, showing a plan to hire mercenaries to try to create chaos to be able to conduct a coup and prevent Daniel Ortega from being reelected in 2021.
Well, Ortega won the last election with 72% of the vote. Current polls show that he would win the next election easily. As a result, the USAID is doing the usual work of regime change. They're talking about an election boycott because they know they can't win. So they're going to try to boycott it.
They tried in Venezuela in 2018.
And they're also still trying to do it the upcoming legislative elections in Venezuela.
Right.
Nicaragua is a tiny country, second poorest in the region, and the U.S. wants to privatize its public services so that our corporations can profit. They want to shrink the minimal social safety net that exists. They want to make neoliberalism run rampant in Nicaragua.
They really want to get rid of the Sandinista revolution. That's been going on for 41 years now, and it was a huge defeat for the United States when that revolution began.
The U.S. has controlled Nicaragua since our Civil War. Since the 1850s was the first U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. The Ortega government and the Sandinistas are popular. They withstood a 2018 U.S. coup attempt, and that just made them more popular.
And then Venezuela, you mentioned there was a hearing last week in Congress where Elliot Abrams, who's like the U.S. special envoy to Venezuela, basically the coup master for Venezuela.
He's now also been put in charge of Iran.
Right, and so he testified in Congress, and no senator said anything about how illegal it is for the United States to be conducting a coup in Venezuela. In fact, they chastised him for not doing a good job.
That's right. This is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But from both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans criticized Abrams for failing in the coup. And especially Senator Chris Murphy, a liberal Democrat from Connecticut, was most open about the coup and how the Democrats could do it better, how Trump and the Republicans bungled an easy coup that could have been done. But no one mentioned the illegality of U.S. It becomes such a norm for the U.S. to conduct coups that no one mentioned this is illegal under international law. Just obscene to see U.S. imperialism so out in the open without any question or any doubt from Democrats and Republicans.
In fact, Joe Biden is, you know, criticizing Donald Trump for being too soft on Venezuela. So,
But Venezuela keeps marching forward. They're going to have an election in December. More parties than ever participating in the upcoming legislative elections. They've enlarged the legislature.
Yeah, and so as people who live in a country that's imperialist, a U.S. empire, we do have a responsibility to stop our country from these illegal interventions in other nations, including the economic war that's being ravaged against Nicaragua and Venezuela in particular.
We have to stop U.S. global gangsterism, which, by the way, is rooted in capitalism, and U.S. imperialism, which is very relevant to our upcoming conversation with Richard Wolff.
So with that, why don't we take a short musical break, and we'll be right back.
Some people get paid for robbing is blind. spending our money, have a hell of a time. Getting bailed out by Congress, so they never fail. Making us wonder why they're all not in jail. You work 60 years, and what do you get? A 401k that's drowning in debt. St. Pelosi, don't you worry as you flaunt your greed. The Fed will print you all the money you need. We're all in mourning, our economy's dead. Only Congress and their friends are getting ahead. We paid Social Security to keep us on track. They say nothing is left, so we won't get it back. You work 60 years, and what do you get? A 401k that's drowning in debt. St. Pelosi, don't you worry as you flaunt your greed.
Clearing the Fed will print you all. Speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeese.
And now we turn to our guest, Professor Richard Wolff. He's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He's also the founder of Democracy at Work, which analyzes capitalism as a systemic problem and advocates for democratizing the workplace as part of the solution. Thank you for taking time to join us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Richard, about the economy at this time. It's such an interesting, scary kind of moment in the U.S. economy. Let's start with a broad overview. Describe what you see in the economy right now.
Well, I see a number of things. The first thing I see is the third crash of our capitalist economic system in this new century. We had the dot-com crash early in 2000, and that's the name it got. Then we had the subprime mortgage crisis. That's the name the second one got in 2008. And here we are with the third one in 2020, which has been now getting the name COVID-19 crisis. You'll notice that in each case, this crisis gets the name of whatever triggered it, as if the blame or the explanation is about the last thing that happened before it hit, rather than the fact that capitalism as a system has always been this unstable. I mean, the economic research says that wherever capitalism has settled in, every 4 to 7 years, it has an economic downturn. And so that's what we should have expected. Here we are in the 20th year. We've had three crashes, works out to near 7, just as it should. So we're witnessing a crisis. But it is worse than other crises, including worse than the first two in this century, for two reasons. Number one, it took more than 7 years. Remember, those are averages. It took more than 7 years between the last crash, 2008, and this one. And typically, if you go for a longer time since the last crash, then the next crash you have is worse than what you would have had it come sooner. I like to say to my students in class that if you lived with a person as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago. The second reason this one is bad is because of the pandemic, because of the fact that not only are we all suffering from this virus and the coronavirus and so on, but here in the United States, it's worse because the political shenanigans of the folks at the top, Trump and the Republicans particularly, was to pretend that there was no issue, that they didn't have to mobilize the society to prepare for such a virus, which they could have and should have done, especially in view of the catastrophic virus we had here in 1918 and many viruses since. But they failed to prepare, and then they failed to contain the virus. Those two things together make this already exaggerated crash even worse. So in a sense, I'm not surprised that it is as awful as it is. Latest count, we have over 30 million people currently receiving unemployment benefits. That flow of money to them is a kind of life support, for not just for them, but for the economy as a whole. Because if you think we're in bad shape now, if we do not financially support the unemployed, plus all the other government programs keeping this economy going, we would be in much worse shape, if you can imagine it, than the one we are in already. So this is going to be, maybe put it this way, the last way. The whole of the 20th century, in many ways, was a response to the great crash of the 1930s. Most of the rest of the century was a fight between those who wanted to consolidate the gains made, particularly by the American working class in the 1930s, in the depths of the Depression. That's when we got Social Security, a minimum wage, unemployment insurance, and government jobs on a scale and in a way we had never seen before in American history. That was one side. And the other side were those who were horrified by all of that because it was paid for in good part by taxes on corporations and the rich. So the rest of the century was literally rolling back the New Deal and the struggle, failed struggle of the Democratic Party and the labor movement to hold on to that New Deal. So my guess is we're going to see the 21st century very much similarly fighting out the implications of what goes on now and in the immediate years ahead. That's how fundamental this economic crisis is.
Wow, it's such a magnified class war. And, you know, I love that this is a trigger because that's how we wrote about it. And that's how every economist we talked to said, you don't blame COVID for this. We were going to have a recession anyway.
Right.
Well, if you read the financial press, which I have to do just for the work that I do, you will know that a preponderance, not 100%, but a preponderance of financial press commentators pretty much across the board were, you know, debating with one another, not whether a downturn was coming, but they would guess about when, and they would guess about how bad it would be. But yes, absolutely, that this system has failed. By the way, this is a 300-year failure. It has tried for 300 years to stop this instability for a very simple reason. Every time the economy crashes, on average every 4 to 7 years, especially when the crash is deep and lasts, the way this one is, the system trembles. And the people who love capitalism have been in the forefront of those trying desperately to find some way, some mechanism, some fix to put in so that either the crises would go away, that was the great objective, or at least they wouldn't be so severe. We even had in the 1930s, we even had the development of a whole way of doing economics, which has since had the name Keynesian economics after the British economist who developed these ideas. But even the Keynesians, with all of their monetary and fiscal policies, have, as we can now see since we're living through it, still not achieved any way to cleanse capitalism of these periodic downturns that hurt so many people, that disrupt so many lives. You would have thought, as I said before, that a system that works this badly when it comes to stability would have had much more of a fundamental challenge than in fact it has so far seen.
So you were recently interviewed by Salon Magazine about whether the United States is a failing state or a failed state. What do you think the U.S. is right now?
Yeah, there's no question in my mind that it's, I don't know what exactly a failed state is. That was not my topic, that was theirs. But if you mean in some more or less commonsensical way, yeah, then I think it failed, and I'll tell you exactly what it failed to do, at least in my judgment, because I'm an economist, so I come at it from the economics. I'm not saying that it didn't fail in other areas, but from the economics perspective, here are the two fundamental failures. We know what viruses are, and we know how they act. The so-called Spanish flu after World War I killed, if I'm not mistaken, upwards of 600,000 or 700,000 people here in the United States. It left its mark on this society in all the ways such a catastrophe does. And we've had ever since then the SARS and the MERS and the Ebola and the you name it. So we know that viruses are a part of the human condition and that any government worth the name has as one of its priorities public health. That's how you judge a government. Has it been able to prepare for that eventuality, take the steps, and I can be really very concrete. Did we have in place the testing mechanisms? Did we have in place the warehouses geographically spread where our population is concentrated, full of the gloves and the masks and the ventilators and the hospital beds and all the other materials that a contagious viral system needs? And the answer is no, we didn't. The private sector didn't do it because it isn't profitable to produce those things, stick them in a warehouse somewhere, and wait for however many years till the next virus comes. So the private sector, capitalism, useless to be prepared, which we all know. And we know it for the simple reason that the exact same logic applies to guns and missiles and tanks and warships. Nobody would produce those things if they then had to sit on them, waiting until the next military adventure. So what the government comes in and does with military equipment is it buys it from the producer at a profitable price as fast as the producer runs it off the assembly line. All the risk of preparing, all the risk of warehousing and holding and monitoring and maintaining all that junk is done by the government to prepare for the military eventuality. Nothing like that was done comparably by the government to prepare for the viral eventuality, which, if anything, is even more scary. And so that's a complete failure of the government to take the kind of role it already knows how to take because of the military. So for me, that's a failed state. The only thing worse than that was to be likewise unprepared for the instability, for the crash, which they had to know was coming since it has happened every 4 to 7 years throughout the history of the United States capitalist system. They weren't ready for that. They didn't have the positions in. They didn't have the programs ready. They couldn't even replicate what they did in the 1930s. So, for example, we haven't even discussed a public employment program. We simply took 30 million people in this country, a fantastic number, considering that they're all workers who then have families, so that number is multiplied by 3 or 4 at least. We took 30 million people and threw them on the unemployment line as if there were no alternative, when in fact we have in this country the alternative of what was done in the 1930s when the government hired these people, much better way of handling the situation, every which way, producing all kinds of useful social effects, none of which were done this time. I mean, these are levels of failure to prepare for and to manage both a virus and a recurring economic downturn that lead you to say, yeah, we live in a failed state. And make no mistake, the underlying condition, if you like, is the ideology, because the ideology tells this society that the private sector is quote-unquote efficient and the public sector is quote-unquote a waste of time, a waste of money, best government is the government that governs least, all the rest of it. This ideology means you leave everything to the private sector. And when the private sector can't perform, which it can't on all kinds of ways, you don't step in with the government to compensate for the failure of the private sector. And you don't do it because no government official dares to say what I just said, namely that we're here to compensate for the failure of private capitalism to prepare for viruses, for example. And so you're hamstrung as a state. You cannot act, and so you fail both to maintain economic well-being and to maintain the public health, and yes, that qualifies you as a failed state.
Yeah, it's amazing how there's such human need and so many people who could help provide that. The government doesn't step in and hire people. It's absurd. One of the really strange things about this collapse, and to me, it's not that strange. That's probably the wrong word. One of the things that stands out about this collapse is the divergence between people's lives. You mentioned 30 million unemployment, 35 million lost jobs, loss of health care insurance, I mean, poverty rising compared to the stock market and the billionaires getting wealthier. Explain to people why that divergence exists.
Okay, I'm glad to do that. And I don't mean to sound like a broken record, and it's not because I want to beat the dead horse. But this is a problem of capitalism, and part of me is always taken aback when people come up against the reality of the capitalist system, which is often very destructive, very ugly, very unfair. And then I realize the power of ideology, which has been to make all of that seem not there or not so important or somehow invisible. So I'm glad of your question because it allows me to answer it. The way capitalism works is it concentrates wealth in the relatively small hands that we now all know as the 1%, or if you like, the top 3%, it doesn't matter. A tiny portion of our people control and own the bulk of the money, wealth in our society. And what those people try to do, either themselves or they hire hedge funds or bankers or someone to do it for them, paying a pretty penny for it, is to get the best possible return for the money that they have. Now imagine a society in which the government, freaked out by the collapse of its economy, is pouring new money into the hands of the super rich, the ones who control the banks and the corporations, who can get the money mostly from the Federal Reserve as it produces new money. Okay, now you add this new money to the existing wealth of the old money, and it's looking for where to make money with their money, because that's what they've been doing all of their life. That's the big problem of wealthy people. It isn't to get the money, because they've already got it. It's to make it grow. That's their goal. So how do you do that? Well, you invest it. Okay, where do you invest it? And here comes the problem. You cannot now invest it in producing goods and services because you can't make any money there. It will not grow. And there's no mystery why it won't. It's because we have a global capitalist crash. We have millions of people unemployed, and they are cutting back on their expenses for obvious reasons. They don't know how long this is going to last. They don't know how bad it's going to get. They're desperately holding on. They're buying their food and so forth. But they are not about to expand their consumption. They are not about to spend money. So the big corporations that produce most of what we have in this country are not expanding. They are contracting. They are trying to survive as their major objective. So investing money in producing goods and services is not going to happen if you have a capitalist system driven by making that money grow. So the people who have the money ask themselves, where else can we put the money? And one of the very few places that have emerged for wealthy folks to put either the old money they already had or the new money being pumped into the economy by the Federal Reserve, they put it into the stock market. Why? Because they hope, and this is really important to understand, they hope that other people just like them, the top 5% or 3% of the population, are figuring out exactly what they have figured out so that they can buy a share of stock, hoping 2-3 weeks or maybe 2 or 3 months later to sell that same share of stock to another person just like themselves who has either old money or the new money and will buy the share from them, hoping to resell that same share to yet another 1%er 2 or 3 months down the road. And so what you've seen pretty much since April of this year, you've seen the stock market go up as all of this, and think of it as a flood of money, old and new, pouring into the one place where you can make some money. And it turns out you can, because there are, in fact, enough people playing the stock market with the old and new money who are not going to put that money anywhere else because they can't earn anything with it, who can borrow from the Federal Reserve at half of 1%, because that's what the interest rate is now, so it's virtually limitless, cheap, virtually free money, and then they can go in, buy a share of stock, hold it for a while, sell it to the next person doing exactly the same thing. And if you're wondering, well, after a while, the prices are going to get crazy if this keeps happening, and it bears no relationship to the underlying economy, that's right. That's exactly what's happening. And in history, we know, because this is not the first time this has happened, not by a long shot, we know that this does not end well. What we call this in financial economics is a bubble, a stock market bubble, and it got the name bubble because we all know what happens in the end with a bubble, which is it bursts, and something will happen when all those people in the stock market who have been buying and rebuying and selling and reselling find themselves in a situation where the latest bunch of stocks they bought at unimaginable prices now looks like it might be the moment when all of this bubble bursts. The minute a significant number of the people playing the market these days think what I just said, they will start selling because they don't want to get stuck with owning stocks whose price is collapsing. So the very self-protective act those first ones take will produce what they fear, namely the crash. And then we're going to see, you know, the lamentation will be spectacular because the only thing that the Trump and Republican parties and the conservatives and all the other parties have been able to point to try to sustain the fantasy that our economy is okay is by looking at the stock market. So if that bursts, then the last thing they had is gone, and no one can predict how bad that will be. But if you want to know what the great fear is that stalks Wall Street as I speak to you, that's it. That there will be a burst, and that it will be horrendous on coming on top of everything else going on in this society.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, whenever the stock market starts to fall, you see the corporate media, you see the government saying, oh, no, things are going to be fine. And, you know, we're going to do what we need to do. I
mean, the Fed pumps more money into it.
Right. I mean, that's one thing. The government
has to, you know, part of that's a very important point, Kevin, because they have to, because they know what I just said. And so the minute that actually happened in the last 2 or 3 months of 2018, the Fed got nervous and it started to stop pumping money in the way it had been doing. And the stock market took a dive, literally a matter of weeks, terrifying everybody. I don't know if you remember that, but then they suddenly reversed themselves and they resumed pumping the money in there because they are now trapped, if you like, by their own addiction. They have to keep pumping money in because now they can see just exactly as I tried to describe it to you, how awful socially and economically it would be if they stopped, and if somehow that's their greatest fear, if they stop pumping money in, and if then you saw that bubble burst, then for the next 10 years, they will be blamed for that, even though it's quite silly because all these things are the product of how this system works. No one part of it deserves or qualifies for the blame for all of it. The Federal Reserve is accommodating a system that would be in very dire shape if it did not fund it with lots of money. By the way, to be clear, the Federal Reserve jumped in with money with the dot-com crisis in 2000. It jumped in with even more money in the 2008 crisis. And now it's broken all records because its intervention with new money is now calculated in the trillions of dollars, which is way more than in the earlier two crashes of this century.
Right. And you mentioned that, you know, Congress wasn't ready to deal with the health crisis or the economic crisis, but what they were definitely ready was how to take this crisis. And in the legislation that they passed, use it to deliver more wealth to those at the top. So you've written recently that you don't think that capitalism can survive the 2020s. Can you expand on that for our listeners?
Yeah. You know, one point that you made, just a comment, you're absolutely right. The Congress of the United States is used to functioning in a certain way. It's been doing that for as long as any other person sitting there can remember. And so in a way, it isn't surprising that even with a pandemic and even with a humongo economic crash on a scale of the Great Depression, they still do what they always do. There are a few young voices, AOC, people like that, who say something different. But yeah, the majority of them are once again, I mean, I'm watching, for example, the post office, this unspeakable decision to raise the package delivery rates that the post office charges, which of course allows then FedEx and UPS to raise their prices. So it's a great gift of profitability to the private package deliverers, coupled with cutting the wages and benefits of the postal workers. And that in a time of pandemic. You scratch your head. Historians will look back at moments like this when actions are taken like this and ask themselves, how is it possible that the people living at that time did not recognize the signs of their own disintegration? So with that as background, I think we're in that time now. This is not a thought I've had before. I'm not an alarmist particularly. I am not a pessimist, never have been in my life. I generally look at the possibilities more than the risks. But as I look at the American capitalist system, I don't see ways out. And so, yeah, if you push me, we are at a time, I think, of a spectacular decline in the United States of our economic system. It can't protect the public health, which in a way is the first demand. You got to provide people with food, clothing, shelter, and reasonable protection of their health. You can't do that, then you no longer qualify. And for the mass of people, it may take a while, but they reach pretty much the same decision. If we now have the threatened tsunami of evictions, and we then have a country with millions of people sitting on the street, staring across that street at the apartments that are empty while they are forced to be out in the street. Then you have failed in the housing area. You have failed in the job area. I mean, you're wiping out whatever savings the working class in this country had, which wasn't much in the first place. They're over indebted as they can possibly be. And as I say, I don't see a way out. We're not going to grow our way out of this because the growth capability of capitalism has moved. It's not located in the United States by and large. There are some exceptions. Certain areas of American industry, particularly telecommunications, computers, and so on, are still growing. But the vast bulk of our production is now done in other parts of the world. Capitalism in China and India, you know, the Chinese economy, and this is not an endorsement of China or a lack of criticism of China. Lots of things about China that deserve criticism. But for the last 25 years, they have grown their output at roughly three times the rate of growth of the United States. Their economic system is outperforming the United States for 25 years. You can play whatever games you want, but the reality on the ground is that capitalism as a dynamic growing system isn't doing that in the United States, or for that matter in Western Europe, or for that matter in Japan. It's mostly doing it in China, India, and increasingly Brazil and other places. And I don't see the American economy, I don't see where I can look for developments that would give me the reason to believe that we have a way out of the catastrophe that has now fallen on us. And I begin to see also that we are in that place that you get to when you've had big economic and social problems, but you have somehow imagined that they would go away. And so, to use the language of our politics, you kick the problem down the road. We have had a growing problem of inequality in this country. Not only have we not solved it, but it has gotten steadily worse across the 20 years of this century. And it's worse today than last year or the year before. At the same time, we have not solved our racial problems. We have not solved our ecological problems. We obviously haven't solved the problem of the instability of our economic system. And I could go on. What I'm seeing is the nightmare. When all of the problems you postponed dealing with, that you hoped would go away, that economic growth would somehow magically solve, that's not happening. And now you're getting the problem of multiple crises, multiple catastrophes happening at the same time. You don't have a good system to handle any of them. You certainly cannot handle all of them. And the symptom of it all, I would summarize in where we are right now. This is a society in the most extreme crisis, at least since the Great Depression, that is just shy of a century ago. So, and in that moment of extreme crisis, we are being told that the choice of leadership is between a Trump and a Biden. If I were a lawyer, I would stand up and say, I rest my case. This is a sign of a system that is determined not to face, let alone deal with, the depth of its crisis.
Yeah, system failure seems pretty evident across the board.
Yeah.
Well, this is probably our last question. With all this sign of collapse on so many different fronts, hopefully it's always darkest before the dawn. What do you see as the potential for the future, and what can people do to help us get to a different approach?
Well, here's my hope, and I have the hope, and I am inspired by a number of things. First and foremost, that there's political movement in the United States, that the long, dry period in which, of course, there's always some movement, and I'm always grateful for it, but there's more now, whether it's Black Lives Matter or the anger about excessive police force or the ongoing ecological movements. There are people getting upset, getting angry, and realizing that they have to get together with others to make change. So for me, that's always good news, positive sign. But I'm even more hopeful because I see a kind of, how should I put this, ideological reckoning settling into the population. What I see when I survey, you know, podcasts or radio TV interviews or things, I'm beginning to get the sense, and I hope this is not wishful thinking, although I suspect I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. I'm beginning to sense that people understand that all of this is a systemic problem. In other words, that they're not once again going to be deflected, diverted into imagining that you can fix this with some piece of legislation or new regulation or deregulation or some cosmetic adjustment, but that you're dealing with something much more fundamental. It's a little bit like recognizing that when you did all the things, the dramatic achievements of the 1930s, I mean, I go back there because for me, in terms of economics, that was the heroic period. I mean, mass movement from below, the CIO, the two socialist parties, the Communist Party, the alliance among all of them, that's what got us the Social Security system, the unemployment compensation system, the minimum wage, and the government jobs for 15 million Americans. Unspeakable achievements never before achieved by the working class in this country, and never again anything comparable achieve afterwards. So I look at that and I say, okay, we did it. We did it once before. So we know we can do it. What is the lesson to be learned about how to do it and what were the mistakes? And the how to do it is the organizing that is going on in the United States. Nobody knows how best to do it. Everybody is trying. Lots of people are trying. That's our best chance that they'll figure it out. What is the mistake to be avoided? And here's the key one for me. The mistake that was made back then was to say, okay, we have Social Security, we have unemployment compensation, we have a minimum wage, we have public jobs. So we don't need to make a systemic change. That is, we don't need to alter the basic way goods and services are produced and distributed in our economic system. So to be blunt, they left the capitalist structure of enterprises in place. They did not remove the capitalists from their position. They allowed the same capitalists who brought the Great Depression to sit in their same positions through the Great Depression and thereafterwards. All they did was make them pay some taxes and lend a lot of money to the government, but they left them in the position of owning, operating, and gathering into their hands the profits of enterprise. And so that was a mistake. And the reason it was a mistake is you then ended the Great Depression with World War II. And in 1945, those corporations that you had left intact had an incentive to undo all of the reforms you achieved. Why? Because they were expensive. They wanted to cut their taxes. They didn't want to pay for all of those things, Social Security, unemployment, all of it. They didn't want to do that. That wasn't something they ever wanted to do. And they were determined, and they had the incentive that their profits would go up if they got rid of all of the entitlements that the New Deal had achieved. So they had the incentive. Unfortunately, by leaving them in their positions, you also gave them the resources with which to realize their incentives. They had the profits, which they could use to undo the New Deal. And for me, that's been the basic political agenda of my lifetime. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio. My father worked in a steel mill when I was born because they used to have those there in that part of the country at that time. And I have watched throughout my childhood and my adulthood how everything that was achieved in the 1930s has either been undone or has been sharply reduced or is in the process of being undone. And that, I think, is a lesson. That this time, reforms, repetitions of what happened then, however well-meaning, are going to make the same mistake unless they change the structure so that they do not leave in place a minority with the incentive and the resources to undo the reforms. Because we've been there and we've done that, and we cannot afford to do that again. If that argument is made effectively, I think there's a chance that the reform movements of today will understand that they have to take steps the reform movement last time didn't, to its own detriment. And that gives me hope, at least that there's a possibility, that this time the changes to be made in the wake of this pandemic disaster might work out better than the last time.
Well, Rick, thank you for your clarity and for taking the time to talk to us today. Folks can read your book, Democracy at Work, and follow your ongoing work at the website, Democracy at Work. But thanks again for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure, and thank you both for the work you do. I counter it all the time, and I really have to tell you that a good number of times in my audiences, people who are nodding, you know, the kind of person you see as you talk, has the ideas and is getting what you're trying to get across. And then they come up at the end of my talk and they've been reading your stuff, and then you are then my collaborators. And I just wanted to acknowledge that as well.
Well, thanks so much. Let's hope this next new deal doesn't save capitalism, but ends it. Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Let's go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want Because
The People Organized
Can Build the Kind of Future
We Want.
Our brothers and our sisters, the people together can overthrow the system.